can produce extreme gentleness and quiet of mind, and even something like vision. But he has often seen men led by it into anger, malice, and impatience. That is because those men have had efficient tempers. The paradoxical thing is the moderate fatigue is a better cause for peevishness than absolute exhaustion. This depends partly on the physical cause, but partly on something else. It is not fatigue simply as such that produces the anger, but unexpected demands on a man already tired. Whatever men expect, they soon come to think they have a right. They have a right to. The sense of disappointment can, with very little skill on our part, be turned into a sense of injury. It is often men have given in to the irremediable after they have despaired of relief and ceased to think, even a half hour ahead, that the damage of humble and gentle weariness begins.
Okay, talking about fatigue. It's something that most of us can identify with. We deal with those effects all the time. And what he's saying in here is sometimes it's not the extreme fatigue, but it's just, it's actually more of a state of mind that Satan has to work with. So picture this. It's about 15 minutes before time for you to go home from your job, and something comes up that something that's a big project that just fell into your lap, and you know you're going to be there for another hour to 2 hours now to take care of this problem. You've probably had that happen at some point in your life, and it's not so much that you're exhausted physically, but you already had your mindset, I'm going home in 15 minutes. And now because of this, I'm not. And so that's what he's talking about. Now you feel an injury because of it. So, you know, especially if this could have been taken care of a couple hours ago and the person just now dropped it on you right whenever it was time for you to go home. And by the way, I need this ready on my desk in the morning. We feel a sense of injury there. Contrast that to the exact same situation, but you've already known for a week that on Thursday you're going to be staying late to do a project. So you've already accepted that. You've set your mind on it. In some cases, you may even be looking forward to it, of getting this project done and out of the way that you've been meaning to do. And there's a completely different mental state when you have to stay late that day, because you already expected it and you planned for it. Are you any more or less tired on either of these days? No. He says it's not the exhaustion. He said it's the people's idea that I've got a sense of injury because I didn't plan to do this. It wasn't my idea to do this. And so now you're infringing on my time. And so Screwtape says that's how you can get to people. He said it's not by them being physically exhausted that's the problem. It's when they've already got their mind made up of what they're going to do, and then you switch things up on them. Or send a hurricane, or whatever it is that interferes with your plans. But it creates this situation in your mind. For me, it's bedtime. I'm getting ready to lie down from there, and then I get a call from Molly that says, "Oh, I've got car trouble. Can you come get me? You know, I'm a half an hour away." Well, it's my bedtime. You know, I was already had my jammies on and already settled in with the dogs, and now that I've got to get up and spend the next hour going out and either, you know, getting this problem solved or whatever it is, and so I don't generally arrive in the best state of mind at that point, you know, and so you know, we tend to take it out on whoever it is that caused this injury to us. So he says that's how you can work on the patient.
Yeah, she got down on the way to the beach.
Yeah, I didn't have to go take care of that one. That was his problem. So, what do you see about that situation? What's Satan's inroad to you when you're now in that state of mind? You feel you've got an injury here because of your time. Somebody's made a demand on your time that you weren't planning on, and now you're upset about it.
Well,
So how is Wormwood supposed to take that and use it to his advantage?
You completely justify by showing malice toward the person, anger toward the person.
Oh, okay. We're justified now. It's perfectly okay now for me to do anything I want, right? Okay. So what kind of things now are going to happen as a result?
You got to get worse. And, you know, keep it in the forefront of your mind. The next sentence there is quite telling. You know, when men, it says, after men have given in to the irremediable thing, this can't be fixed, so I'll go ahead and do it. You know, even though I'm going to be tired and worn out with it. After they have despaired of belief and ceased to think even a half hour hit, okay, I'll forget everything else. I'll take care of it. You know, that's when Satan loses his grip.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have it in the front of your head anymore. You know, thinking, you know, fire and brimstone gets this person that's inconvenient.
Exactly.
I think that one of the things that Satan oftentimes does to us in those situations is appeals to our desire for fairness.
Okay.
You know, this isn't fair. Why am I the one who has to stay after? Why am I the one who has to fix this when someone else is the one who caused it to begin with? If they had done their job, I wouldn't have to do it. You know, all of those kinds of things. And it's not fair.
Right.
And somewhere along the line, Satan has convinced us that life is supposed to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not fair, then we have a right to write and complain about it.
Mm-hmm.
My response to that has always been, I'm glad life isn't fair.
Mm-hmm.
Because if life was fair, then Jesus wouldn't have died on the cross and we'd still be lost in our sins.
Exactly.
And, so we need to keep that in mind and realize that that's one of his great weapons that he uses, is appealing to that sense of fairness that is really, in so many ways, misguided. We should not have an expectation that life is always supposed to be fair.
Yes.
Because there's nothing that guarantees that.
You're going to be sorely disappointed.
Exactly.
We get the mindset that it's all about me. And that's what's important to me and how I'm thinking and how I'm, you know, it's self-centeredness. I think what's the light and courage in life. Whereas when Jesus is more the servant mindset, you know, we should be willing to offer, you know, whatever service, we should be doing whatever our purpose is.
Well, that was what I was going to say. I was going to use an example. Last weekend, we were supposed to go away for the weekend for my birthday. I've got no vacation this year. And then the hurricane, I mean, we went nowhere this year. And then the hurricane blew in, and we didn't get to go anywhere. And now, on top of that, I've got no electricity. And because we have a well, I have no running water. Because we're going to be plugging in time to plug in the well pump. And so, yeah, you do tend to kind of start wallowing in that self-pity. And then you go back to work, oh, my electricity never went out. Well, I hate you. That's not fair.
Yep.
I just spent my birthday in the dark without being able to take a shower. Oh, well. But we do. We start getting into that mindset of it's not fair. Why me? That's the question we start asking.
Exactly right. And Russ was talking about the telephone lineman that, you know, instead of people going by and thanking them for all the hard work they've been putting in and getting their power restored, you know, people are going around and verbally abusing the people who are trying to restore their power out there. When's my power going to be up?
Well,
you guys are taking your time. Yeah, it's easy for us to feel like we're the aggrieved party. I was just thinking the other day that, you know, these guys may be without power at home and they've got trees down in their yard and they've got their own problems, and yet they're still working 16-hour shifts trying to restore your power.
And they probably go home and their wife's complaining, where's our power?
Yeah, exactly. Sure, you go bring up the neighbor's power over here, where's our power?
I guess that must be kind of common. I came by on Friday, you know, the trucks that I know. I rolled my window down and I said, buddy, I'm glad to see you guys. And the lineman just looked at me, kind of blinked, you know, and said, well, she chuckled a little and said, well, thank you. So I could tell that he was used to hearing the other.
Oh, yeah.
Way too much. Yeah. But,
I think sometimes we get so into take it for granted. Mm-hmm. And when they don't work in our favor in life, so I just really bless everybody. I just keep it all sometimes. Mm-hmm. Why did this have to happen to me? It's because to me it wasn't bad. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to start praying for these men that they would be safe on the job, and they're working long hours, mm-hmm. or working their family. They have trucks coming from other states. Mm-hmm. They have, but I never forget, we were out of power for 4 days, and it was summertime. So I went around the corner, and I saw this truck that I didn't know anything about. So I'm up there. I said, "Hey, man, thank you for what you're doing. I sure appreciate you getting my lights on. Thank you. Bye." I was just glad to see it. Mm-hmm. I was even just really the best folks. These people working some of the most dangerous jobs that they can possibly work. Mm-hmm. And we can't find out the people mold it up, hit it. Y'all be ashamed of that. Yeah. Instead of praying for these men, that they'd be saved. And they can get back on the business. Without power.
Life has a way of just stopping up in our tracks. Last week, it did. Gave families time to sit down and come together. Gave neighbors time to help one another. You know, it was a great bonding time, you know. Mm-hmm. So there was some good that came out of it all. It's been fighting for what we had to do. But it wasn't.
Yeah, I've never had a conversation with my neighbor lady until Belle went over to cut the tree to get out of her driveway. I mean, she was, yeah.
Ice, food, you know, get back and forth across the street, helping each other, checking on elder neighbors.
Yeah.
And things.
All right. He says that it works better whenever you get people with moderate fatigue. When you get to complete exhaustion, you don't have time for feeling anger or malice or anything. You just want to rest. Exactly. So he says, you know, that brings gentleness and quiet of mind and even something like vision. You know, when you're exhausted, sometimes all you can do is sit there and think. And so he says that's not a good time for Satan to work on you. It's when you're a little bit tired. Is whenever you're the most likely to feel aggrieved and when you still have the energy to sin as a result of feeling aggrieved about something. Okay. Any other comments? Somebody read paragraph number 2. What Satan wants to do is to fix in our mind what a reasonable period of time is. You know, I can do without my power comfortably for a day, but once it gets beyond a day, you know, now I have a right to feel aggrieved on here. Or, okay, I don't mind working overtime 30 minutes, but that's all that I feel like I ought to have to work overtime. You know, it's funny, some days I work later than others. And if I've got my mindset that I'm going to get off at my what I would consider my usual time, if I have to stay later, I feel particularly irritated and exhausted. Whereas if it's a day I'm scheduled to work an extra 2 hours, I don't really even notice the difference until I get to that point. And then I'm tired, and then I'm ready to go home. So it's all in this mental attitude that we have about what's our time and what's somebody else's time. And so he says when somebody's going through a period of trial, the idea is for them to fix in their mind how long they're going to be gracious and tolerant about this. And then he says if you can get that set just a little bit less than what the actual time is, now they feel aggrieved. From going back to military days, it's kind of like if you're on a deployment. You already know it's going to be 30 days. Okay, you go out and you're happy as a clam doing what you're supposed to do for your 30 days. But then you hear, well, we've got a problem here with getting your replacement or your transportation. You're going to be here an extra 2 days. Those extra 2 days are the longest time during your life because you already had your mindset, okay, this is the date I'm going home. And now you want me to stay 2 days longer, even though it's only 2 days, but somehow in your mind, you've suffered this terrible injury, and you're really asking a lot of me to stay this extra length of time that I wasn't counting on. Okay, so he says that if you can do that and you get people in that state of mind, that's whenever they're susceptible. All kinds of suggestions that you can plant in their mind of, now then, since I've got this personal injury, as Jerry said, now I'm justified in whatever it is I want to do. So that's the time whenever you're likely to do something that you shouldn't do. No matter what the situation is, there's always an opportunity there for you to do something simple. And so that's what Satan wants to work on. For you to say things you shouldn't say, to do things that you shouldn't do, and to tear up relationships with people, because you know you can be on the other end of it. What? You're going to have to stay late today? And so now then you take it out on that person who it wasn't their fault, but you know Satan wants to disrupt that relationship that you've got.
You
got 30 minutes in.
Yeah.
After that, we quit listening.
And I, you know,
that's going to be a lot.
They've already started going to sleep, you know, what have you. But you know, one of the things that I have noticed in different times over the years of ministry, that sometimes with people there's a disappointment when someone responds to the invitation and they want to get baptized. Because now what's going to happen?
You're infringing on my time.
Now it's going to take another 20 minutes before we get out of here, and I certainly can't get up and leave.
Right. The Baptists are going to be all in line ahead of us at the restaurant.
It's going to be filled with everybody, and, I think sometimes, you know, that's an example of Satan. Satan is saying funny, but that's an example of how Satan works, you know.
Yeah.
It seems like it's something that's so... you know, petty, but in reality, does that not tell us something about what our mindset is? You know, that we're willing to give God this amount of time and this amount of time only, and if it goes over, well, then, you know, that's infringing on my time or, you know, whatever the case may be. And so, you know, we need to realize, again, that's something that Satan does. It's one of his tools. And, you know, people so often think that, you know, I think we don't realize how active that Satan is, even when we're sitting in this building and we're having worship together. Satan doesn't stop at the doors out here. Mm-hmm. You know, the last thing that he wants us to be doing is worshiping God. And, you know, and doing that in spirit and truth. And so he can work his way into things just like that. And he'll do that.
Man, she's going back up there again this week.
Yeah.
Oh, he's going back up there again. Man, that's kind of how some of that stuff seems to work, but we need to be focusing on what thus says the Lord. Because any given Sunday, we could be up there. We need to be going up there ourselves and asking God forgiveness even for that act. Because once you think about it, hey man, it's pretty much over. It's pretty much over. We need to be working on the things that the Lord wants us to do and have patience with other people when they have to go up to the front. Because it means something. It takes a lot of miracles, as far as I'm concerned. It takes a lot to go up there and ask for forgiveness. And that's the joyous time when somebody wants to ask the Lord. You shouldn't be looking at our watch and saying, man, you know. But that happens. It happens.
Mm-hmm. It may not be expressed, but sometimes it's in the back of people's minds.
Dale, the main reason I brought that up as a preacher is because I'm going to have an extra long sermon.
What I thought. Figured you were prepping us for that.
Can you, as an educator, tell me how long people can concentrate?
Yep. But they say that your minutes of your attention span is equal to your age in years. So you know, if you're 50 like me, you might can listen to a 50-minute sermon. But whenever you're 20, then you can listen to a 20-minute sermon before your mind starts to wander. But that's kind of the way it works. And I've noticed too, you know, that I'll be sitting in a meeting and. Or whenever I was in class, you know, I would always look down at my watch, and it was always, for some reason, 45 minutes into the class period that I looked down and looked at my watch to see how much longer until this is over. But you've got that certain attention span that varies from person to person. But it takes an effort.
Jerry can fall asleep on
I thought that you got no.
I don't know. Yeah, Jerry should be good for a couple hours. Yeah, we could stay here till the evening service.
That's true. They could do the lock-in.
Yeah, there you go. Lock-ins get harder on you as you get older. Okay, somebody could read paragraph number 3.
I do not know whether he is likely to meet the girl under conditions of strain or not. If he does, make full use of the fact that up to a certain point, fatigue makes women talk more and men talk less. Much secret resentment, even between lovers, can be raised from this. Probably the scenes he is now witnessing will not provide material for an intellectual attack on his face. Your previous failures have put that out of your power. But there is a sort of attack on the emotions which can still be tried. It turns on making him feel, when first he sees human remains plastered on a wall, that this is what the world is really like, and that all his religion has been a fantasy. You will notice that we have got them completely fogged about the meaning of the word real. They tell each other of some great spiritual experience. All that really happened was that you heard some music in a lighted building. Here, real means the bare physical facts separated from the other elements in the experience they actually had. On the other hand, they will also say, it's all very well discussing that high dive if you sit here in an armchair, but wait till you get up there and see what it's really like. Here, real is being used in the opposite sense to mean not the physical facts, which they know already while discussing the matter in armchairs, but the emotional effect those facts will have on human consciousness. Either application of the word can be defended, but our business is to keep the two going at once so that the emotional value of the word real can be placed now on one side of the account and now on the other, as it happens to suit us.
The next one goes right along with it, so could you read number 4 also?
Okay. The general rule, which we have now pretty well established among them, is that in all experiences which can make them happier or better, only the physical facts are real, while the spiritual elements are subjective. In all experiences which can discourage or corrupt them, the spiritual elements are the main reality, and to ignore them is to be an escapist. Thus in birth, the blood and pain are real, the rejoicing in mere subjective point of view. In death, the terror and ugliness reveal what death really means. The hatefulness of loveliness of a loved person is merely a subjective phase conceiving a real core of sexual appetite or economic association. Wars and poverty are really horrible. Peace and plenty are mere physical facts about which men have happen to have certain sentiments. The creatures are always accusing one another of wanting to eat the cake and have it. But thanks to our labors, they are more often in the predicament of paying for the cake and not eating it. Your patient, properly handled, will have no difficulty in regarding his emotion at the sight of human entrails as a revelation of reality, and his emotion at the sight of happy children or fair weather as mere sentiment. Your affectionate uncle, Steve Davis.
Okay. So, he launches into a discussion about what's real and what's just emotion or sentiment in here, and we can easily confuse the two, and Satan is going to work it to his advantage, whichever situation that is, because it's easy for us to go to an especially good worship service where we've had a very enlightening and entertaining sermon that was less than 30 minutes, and we were all, we leave here in a good mood and feeling very spiritual, or you go to a gospel meeting, or maybe a youth rally or something, or Christian camp, and you leave there and you're all excited and you're all fired up, and then you get back into what we call the real world, and then you think, oh, okay, well, that was just a wave of emotion, but now I'm back to what's real, and what's real is the daily grind and all of those things. And so we can tend to separate those two things as far as what's real. But he says in some cases you can use that emotion. He uses the example of the diving board, and as somebody that's deathly afraid of diving, I can sympathize with this. You look at a diving board from the ground and you say, well, that's not that high. And then you get up there on the top and you scream like a little girl when you look down. And so there, that it's that emotion is what's real to you. And so that seems real rather than the physical height of the diving board, which from the ground you look at it, well, it's only a little taller than my head, but somehow it looks a lot higher when you're at the top. And so Satan says, try to compartmentalize, okay, that religion stuff is just something that you kind of get worked up about, and maybe you shed a tear when you're in the worship service, but it really doesn't affect your daily life in any way. You still get back into the real world, and you have to go back to your job and do the things that you have to do and cheat on your taxes and cheat on your wife and do all those things that real people do out in the real world. And so Satan doesn't want these things that we talk about in Bible class or in the worship service to affect that real life. Or he wants us to come in here and talk about God creating the world and then get back into the real world and recognize, oh, okay, well, that's a nice way to say it, but science has really explained all that. Really it was all just purely natural processes. And school children are perfect at that kind of thing. They can come to Sunday school class and say all the right things, and then they can go to school and say all the right things. And have this wall down the middle that they don't try to ever combine those two things and make them all fit into the same reality. But Satan is wanting us to do that and to keep our religion separate from our real world. What are your thoughts on that? Is it effective?
I've always tried for myself, when I get to wondering about that, or you have what's really happening, I like to substitute in my thoughts the word eternal for the word real. Okay. When you do that, at least for me, it helps tremendously. What's the one real thing that you add? If you use the word eternal, it's our soul. That's the realest thing we possess. Because it's going to be here forever. Not on this earth, but it's going to be. We have all of this in front of us. To beat up on some English authors, I guess. It really is kind of a mere illusion. We're just a vapor, here on earth for a little while. Mm-hmm. It's easy for us to lose sight of that.
Mm-hmm. And imagine your perspective from eternity up there in heaven, and you look back and you say, I was worried about those things.
Like that.
that really bothered me. Did I really think God was going to let me just starve to death? Was I really that concerned that God was going to make sure that somehow I had the things that I needed? And yeah, you know, we're missing power. How could we possibly have thought that was a big deal? Especially when there's people in the world that never have power, and somehow they've managed to endure. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that we've got to come to terms with is that we make the mistake of associating physical with reality. And so if it's not physical, then it may not be real. And that's not true. We've got to be able to separate those two concepts. Just because something I can't see, it doesn't mean it's not real. Our life kind of revolves around the physical, and to us that's real. There's a whole other realm, a spiritual realm, that is real, even though it's not physical. And I think sometimes we get lost in physical, real, or reality, and we lose, we don't focus enough on spiritual reality. And that's one of the things that Satan can do to us. As long as he can keep us focusing on what's, quote unquote, in our mind, real, that is the physical, then he can keep us contained. And we're not focusing on the spiritual reality.
And spiritual warfare is kind of like real warfare in that sense. In the Air Force, real property was considered to be something you could stub your toe on. But the real power of the military wasn't in having those pieces of equipment sitting around. It was in the abilities of the people that could use them and that could turn equipment into warfighting capability. And so the power was in the spirit of the people that were willing to go out and do what it took to win a war. And that's the way spiritual warfare is. It's not in the fact that we have a building and we have songbooks and we have Bibles and all these real things. The spiritual warfare is what's going on in our lives and what's happening in our spirits and our ability to go and our willingness to go and wage that war against Satan. And sometimes Satan, it seems like he's winning. When we're discouraged and when we're down and when we say, I just can't do this anymore, then we've reached that psychological end of our rope, when in reality it's something in our mind. You know, we can do whatever we set our minds to. It's a matter of readjusting your thinking. Okay, maybe this isn't so bad after all. Maybe I can go on another 2 days, another year, whatever it is that with the situation that I'm dealing with. If I decide I can, then I can. There's an old saying, if you think you can't, you can't. If you think you can, you can. Both of those are correct.
Well, what I was thinking when I was talking about the difference between being kind of tired and being completely exhausted, I thought about Job. If anybody had to be completely exhausted, it was Job. All of the people around him were just kind of tired.
Right.
They went to him and they said, why don't you just, if I were in your position, I would just curse God and die and just be over with. But he talks about how when you're completely exhausted, sometimes that gives you that time to really stop and think about things and think about and contemplate things. And I think that sometimes when we really, well, we should, but sometimes that's when we really draw closer to God. Sometimes it's when we're at that Red Sea moment, as Russ likes to call it. But when you're just a little bit tired, that's when you start flying off the handle and saying things you should say and do things you shouldn't do.
The time's about up. Any last closing comments? All right. So, Kev, could you close this in prayer?
Father, good that we can talk about things like this and think about those things that influence our lives. But we know, Father, that you are aware of it all. And we know, Father, that you love us. And we ask them, and Father, that you help us and give us strength.